Hey guys, Ron Newcomb here, the Indie Coach. I'm here with Jerome Corchon, a buddy of mine that we were just discussing. Flew him out to DC to do a seminar all the way back in 2008. And he just brought a wealth of knowledge, specifically in the area of distribution. So although I'm a coach to the artists and the arts in general and storytelling, I really do, as you know, see through the lens of filmmaking. And so a lot of the things that I'm interested in and want to bring in and offer a perspective is around the filmmaking community. And so Jerome has been in the business for quite some time. It's changed a lot. He's seen a lot of things that have changed. And I would love to, I really was hoping to get him in, and I'm glad he accepted to bring his perspective and knowledge in over the past years, and then kind of talk about where he's at currently and where we kind of see ourselves as filmmakers and where we can go. So the idea is, the idea of coach is this incremental growth elements that I recognized that I had all throughout my life playing sports. And I had real significant short element of growth, but in a high impact when I would play these sports things. And that's kind of the idea of a coach versus like a overall mentor of like one's life. So that's what I'm trying to do is also learn from others, of course. So taking people like yourself, Jerome, and talking to you and trying to ascertain exactly how you might have done something. And if we could take it and apply it to our lives, then all the better. And that can help us not to maybe step on some landmines and make progress. So again, welcome and thank you for doing this, Jerome. But if you could, man, just talk to us a little bit about how you got into this crazy film business and maybe how you also, because I don't believe you started out this way, but found your way into the niche of distribution.
Yeah, well, it's a long story, but the nutshell version is I first came to LA from college in Santa Barbara, and then I am originally from Chicago, so Midwestern born and bred, and then I came to LA to pursue a career as an actor. Enjoyed it, except I didn't enjoy the pounding the pavement every day and trying to find work.
Right.
After a period of time, I always knew I might write and maybe eventually produce. And I just started to do that finally after a number of years and made my first movie. Kind of a big chill for Gen X. And if anybody doesn't know what the big chill is, it was kind of a touch point maybe for the baby boomer generation.
Yeah.
And it's a good film. It's still worth seeing, even if you're a Gen X, a millennial or a Gen Z.
Yeah.
Had a hell of a time getting distribution. Took me 4 years to run the gauntlet of film festivals and contacting distributors. I finally did get a deal, but it was only after I had opened the movie theatrically in a couple of cities, which was not something a lot of people did at the time. It's not for the faint of heart. It's very difficult. It can work to an indie film's advantage. And most of the time it doesn't work, but sometimes it does. It kind of worked for me in a way. I got a deal with Warner Brothers. The movie was released nationally. And then I started writing articles about it for film magazines, Movie Maker Magazine and some others. And then people would call me up on the phone. Hey, Jerome, they track me down online. Hey, Jerome, yeah. I love what you did. Great. Congratulations. I need help. And then I would try to help them. But you can't teach distribution to somebody in an hour phone call.
Yeah.
So eventually I gravitated to teaching a 2.5, 3 hour class on distribution. That expanded to a 1 day and then a 2 day. I did a 1 day with you in DC way back when, and then expanded to a 2 day. And then I ended up putting together a 3 day, what I called a 3 day DVD course, 18 hours of instruction that every producer should know, the A to Z of distribution, not so much in the weed stuff, but the stuff that everyone really should know.
Yeah.
And then I was doing, and then I consulted. I taught and consulted about distribution for 15 years. And then in 2022, I bit the bullet and decided to open my own distribution company because I understand it. I know how to do it. It's kind of a natural progression. And then people would say, Jerome, we thought you would do this 5 years ago.
Yeah.
anyways, that's how I got into that. You know, I fell into this arena in this kind of niche of the industry.
Yeah.
In a way by accident, but maybe not. And I'm good at it. And I really have a great sense of marketing, which is important in distribution. A lot of people don't, a lot of filmmakers don't really understand marketing or understand what a good poster is,
yeah,
or what a good trailer is and all of that. It's all about, I mean, when you get to distribution, it's about marketing and sales.
Yeah. You know? No, absolutely.
Go ahead.
So you were an actor, which I love, because I was too. That's kind of what got me into this whole crazy business as well, was a passionate love for acting and telling story. And by default, because no one was asking me to jump into their projects, I became a producer. I kind of had this theory, and I'd love to get your take on it, that almost everyone, at least in the indie perspective, should become a producer. Like, it really gives you an in the industry, a know-how in the industry, and it also allows you and equips you to control your own path, if you will, particularly for us actors, actor types. And I encourage people to go out and try to learn that role, whether or not they are called to it or pick it up full time. It's a fantastic skill set to have. And it seemed like that is kind of the way that you went. By default, you kind of just produced it, and you shot on 35, if I'm remembering right. Correct?
Yeah, the first movie I shot on 35 millimeter, which was, boy, you know, talk about going to hell and back. It was hell, but, you know, but that was the choice at the time. The digital revolution was just around the corner.
Yeah, it didn't happen yet. Yeah.
When I shot, if I had waited a couple years,
right, you might you have. Know, yeah.
then I would have shot on, you know, SD, which, you know, isn't the, you know, I mean, thank God we're on HD and UHD now, but still, it was hell. It was hell. And but it looks great. You know, it looks great on the screen. Yeah.
No, it does.
Look, I think, you know, producing, the challenge, I think, for a lot of indie filmmakers today is that if they're a writer, director, you know, writer, actor, director, whatever, unless they've got a producing partner who really understands the business of film, the marketing, the sales, the business.
Yeah.
Then you've got to learn how to do it yourself. And, you know, I can count on one hand the number of very well-known infamous partnerships between a director and a producer, you know, Ron Howard, Brian Grazer, you know, Simpson, Bruckheimer. I mean, there aren't a lot I don't know why. It's just maybe the partnerships. It's not easy to find a partnership when you're an indie filmmaker because you're kind of a loner, maybe a lot of times. And, you know, who am I going to partner with? And I tried to partner when I made my movie with, and I went, you know, one after the other with someone for a year. They fell away. Someone else for another year. They fell away. It's like your producer in the indie world has to have the same passion that you as the writer director has.
Yeah.
Or it's not going to last. And it's so hard in the indie film arena. So but it's important. And so if you don't have that, then you've got to really learn a lot of the skills yourself. You got to take off your creative hat, put on your business hat when it comes time to get your film into the marketplace or do film festivals and then get into the marketplace. And I make a distinction. Film festivals is not really the marketplace. It's a pre-marketplace. You know?
Yeah. No, actually I use one of your words that I picked up in your seminar all the time. And it's the pedigree that, I use that all the time. And I think it's so true because a lot of people almost use that as that's their action plan to get there. And yes, maybe that needs to be the festival route, needs to be certainly an element of it, but you're really, it's establishing your pedigree. As you say, it's not the end game, you know, the allure of the business, you know, you hear, there's a lot of stories that are hard and people hear those, and yet people are still flocked into this storytelling thing. What, in your opinion, and you've been in LA now for quite some time, you didn't grow up there, you moved there for the business. What is that allure that draws people into this business?
I have no idea. You know, I'm kind of, I like to say I'm the black sheep of the family. I'm the one person in the family that took a creative route. Everybody else took your kind of normal type of job.
9 to 5. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, not to get spiritual here, but you know, sometimes if we listen to our heart, you know, and you use the word call just a little bit ago, which, you know, is a spiritual or religious term usually.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just calling to me, and this was my path and my destiny. And I know it, actually, I know it was my path. I didn't expect to be where I am now in this journey of entertainment.
Yeah, right.
But it's where I excel.
Yes. Yeah.
I like it. I enjoy it. I like the challenge. If I'm not challenged, I get bored.
Yeah.
And this is always a challenge, you know, picking up, acquiring people's movies and figuring out how are we going to market this? How are we going to release it? How are we going to have success with it? So for me, I can only really speak for me. I mean, I think sometimes people maybe see the entertainment industry, or they probably do, as, you know, glitzy and glamorous and, oh, you know, hubnub with the stars and all of that. And, you know, we've heard, you know, the stars are normal people. I've met a lot of stars, and, you know, they're regular people, you know, but the public puts them up on pedestals and think they're special. Well, they have a special talent, and that's why they become famous, you know, either their destiny and talent, or who knows, or just talent. I don't know. But, you know, it's, you know, I think it's important that we, whatever we do in life, we choose something that we enjoy, and it can change, right? You might start out as a director, and oh my God, you find that you like producing better, and and that becomes your main thing. You know, or you do both over time.
Yeah, no, I definitely was that way for me. I got into this whole thing for acting, started to write stuff because, again, I wasn't finding what I wanted out there, found a great writing partner, and then fell in love with directing, you know, because there's a lot of acting element, I think, within that. And so directing is something I love. Producing is something I do because I feel that I have to. And writing is something that is like a honing of a skill with that. But like you, I did a feature. And I was a police officer, got out of the police department, did a feature film. And that was definitely my film school. You know, it was definitely the Tarantino model. It sounds like you went the same route.
Yeah.
And what I found is there was a ton of information on cinematography and gear and equipment and all that, but almost nothing on business. And so like you, when I got distribution, I was being invited to these colleges to speak about the business side of things because the students were getting ready to graduate, and they would tell me, and I only had a couple hours, they would tell me like, wow, we have not heard this in 4 years, and it's the business element of it. And so there is certainly a business component to it.
Well, there is. And every film school should be teaching a course on business. They should make everybody in there in the curriculum take at least one business course that they offer. But film schools, you know, not to slam film schools, because there are great film schools out there, but they're selling the dream. They're selling the Tarantino, the Spike Lee, the Clint Eastwood dream. And if they have a course where you have to learn about business, they think that's boring for filmmakers.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's not going to get them to enter their, you know, pay $70,000 a year to go to USC or whatever.
Exactly.
But that should be part of it.
It certainly should.
You know, because you get out of film school, I don't know, you get out of film school, Full Sail, whatever, and you're, you know, where, what do you, you know, how do you read a contract? I mean, that's boring, but how do you read it? How do you understand a contract?
Though. Sure.
If you don't understand a contract, you're going to get screwed by a distributor.
Yeah.
Probably, you
right.
Know?
Right.
And,
no,
and
I mean,
that,
no,
and,
yeah.
And you're putting 2-3 years into making a movie, probably. And if you get screwed and you make no money, oh, great. You know, how are you going to make another one?
Exactly. No, you want to go again. It's that longevity we're looking for, not the one hit wonder and kind of you're in and out. I think you hit on a key component too, is marketing. That's something that, again, once I got my film out there and I started to talk to other filmmakers, it seemed like invariably they would all go back to, they didn't know how to market their film. And they certainly thought once they got distribution, which you and I both know is a farce, is that the distributor would take it and market it. And that's really not part of the equation. Like, you still need to get out there and pound the drum. And the marketing element is such a such a big component to it. But I wanted to ask you the question from now, you're a distributor. I'm a filmmaker. I have an idea or a film. At what point in the game do you prefer a filmmaker to come to you? And then what materials do you like them to have, if any, that they should come with?
So currently, my business model currently is to acquire and pick up completed movies.
Gotcha.
I know there are distributors out there who get into co-funding and financing and co-production. I don't. At this present time, I don't. My hands are pretty full with picking up completed movies and putting them out there because there's 5,000 to 7,000 indie movies being made every year.
Yeah.
So it's busy. So for me, if somebody says, hey, Jerome, I have an idea for a film and or here's the log line or here's the script, I'm like, OK, great. Good luck. Reach out to me when it's done.
Right.
You know,
right.
There are other distributors that will operate differently. If somebody says, Jerome, I have a movie, we packaged it with these actors, would you be interested? Again, I will say, great. You know, when you shoot it, let me know.
Yeah.
You know, when principal photography is done, let me know. And we'll have a conversation because, you know, 9 out of 10 people who say I've got a script or I've got a package together, we just need to raise this amount of money. 9 out of 10 aren't going to do it. Aren't going to be able to get it done.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's a matter of time, time management for me. And, you know,
yeah, no, if you were to spend every, you know, 10 minutes with each person like that, everybody's well-intended. And you even talked about you get people on board and you get promises and commitment. I always say, though, until you the money's not only in the bank, but you can actually draw from it, then it's real. Until then, it's conjecture. You have a lot of good intent and well-intended people, but it's hard to kind of stipulate like, hey, I can give you this on that, because I think you're very wise to say, hey, go at least get through principle. Let me at least, you know, get something in the can that I could see and then we can talk. But until then, good luck. I'll be rooting for you. You know, let me know when you're done.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I mean, if a film has names in it and they get principal done, sure, I'm open to chatting. If the film has no names in it and principal isn't done, or even if principal is done, but there are no names in the cast, I might still, depends on the genre of the film, I might still say, come to me when it's done. It depends. You know, because films without stars, films without recognizable actors, they don't have to be stars, are even harder to generate revenue with today than movies with names in them. Unless it's a horror film, thriller, vampire, zombie, that kind of thing. It's just the marketplace. I don't know if you would ask me this, but you know, the marketplace really shifted the way viewers and consumers consume content, shifted a lot during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so, whereas before pandemic, if you had a great drama with maybe one semi-recognizable actor in it, you might still be able to make money with it. Today, it's really iffy, really iffy. And maybe the pandemic had something to do with the fact that people just want escapism.
Yeah.
At the present time, they don't want to spend $4 or $5 to watch a drama. It's very hard to get them to watch dramas, especially without actors, recognizable actors. I have a drama with someone that was an A-lister at one time. It's still hard to get people to pay the $5 to see it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, that's a challenge. If you know, speaking to producers and filmmakers out there, you're looking through from a distributor lens, what would you recommend? Like, what are you looking for? Like, what should we be thinking on this side of the fence? What is a distributor looking for?
I would say 99% of the distributors out there are looking for something that will make money.
Yeah.
It's very base, you know, it's very base like that. It's can it make money or not? And I will say this, I will take on a film periodically that I don't know whether it'll make any money or not, but I think it adds something to our culture. It adds a conversation to our society. I picked up a documentary about Asian gangs in Atlanta last year.
Interesting.
Now, you know, it's like, I don't know if it'll make money or not. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but it's a good documentary. And yeah. I'm a critic, and it's good. It's entertaining, it's watchable, and it's not making a ton of money, but it has something important to say. Because in the course of the film, these gang members, some of them end up getting arrested, go to prison, and they change their life when they get out of prison.
Yeah.
So it's a story of redemption in some way. But it's That's a great. True story. But if I get it, last night I watched a drama, no names in it, came to me through a colleague of mine, 2 hours and 2 minutes running time.
Oof. Yeah.
Again, no names. It's a drama.
Eww.
I literally really couldn't get past the first. I gave it a half hour. I gave it the first act. Exposition, background, no inciting incident. I'm like, who cares about these people?
Yeah.
If you don't care about the people in the first 5 minutes, we're going to lose. We lose them today. So, you know, unfortunately, it's just a matter of, can something make money? And for me, again, I have to like the film.
Yeah.
Some distributors won't care about that. Maybe a lot won't care about that. If they think it'll make money, but they don't like it, so what?
Doesn't matter, yeah.
I need to like it.
Yeah.
And every now and then I'll pick up something where I don't necessarily think it'll make money, but I think it should be in the marketplace.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going to get behind it. I like that. You kind of hit on this, and I'm just curious because I see it oscillating a little bit. In one sense, I see it might not matter as much. On the other hand, I see that it matters a ton, and that is star power. Is that still relevant in today's market, particularly in sales and foreign and distribution? Is star power still?
It's important. I would not characterize it as 100% important, but it's, you know, 80% important. I mean, I have films that I'm handling that don't have names in them, but they're genre. They do very well.
Yeah.
So, you know, because of the way audiences have shifted in their viewing habits, basically going largely from paying $4 or $5 to watch a movie to subscribing to a number of streaming services where it's, you know, a buffet. You pay this monthly fee. It's all you can eat.
Yeah.
Right. Genre is easier to get, you know, you hook people in the first few minutes with a genre film and they're going to watch it all the way through. They're going to be fed the ads on the AVOD platforms. They'll be fed the ads. So filmmakers make money from that. Or if it's a subscription service, you know, if you can sell a movie to a subscription service for a license fee, a flat license fee, well, great. Then it doesn't matter if they stop after 5 minutes, but if Netflix looks at your movie and they're bored in the first 5 minutes, they're not going to take it. They're not going to license it.
Yeah.
Or Hulu or Stars or whoever. So, so it's a challenge. Star power. You know, if you've got a film with names in it, usually that means it'll do well. It depends on the names, depends on the level. Again, the drama that I have with a name, couple names in the cast. One of the most well-known actors a long time ago, and then an actress who, again, was in, you know, was like, you, nobody knows, nobody doesn't know who she is.
Yeah.
But it's a drama and it's a hard sell.
Yeah.
It goes to AVOD soon. So we'll see how it does on AVOD, but it's been on TVOD and people just don't want to pay $5.
Yeah. Now, so genre is another one I have a question about, and I don't mean like just the niche like horror genre, but overall, you already mentioned drama, particularly with Without a Name is a hard sell. You have genre films like horror and things that could go and do sell, particularly if your margins are low and you keep the budget low. Are there other genres that you see that buyers are like, hey, Jerome, you know, give me your best action and What's selling?
So the ones that read the kind of films that do the best, names or no names, doesn't matter, are genres, as you just said, horror, thriller, supernatural, vampire, zombie, any of that. They do great. Especially if they're good, you know.
Yeah, right.
Even if they're mediocre, they can still do well.
Catch fire, yeah.
Then there's Family Can Do Well. Faith-based movies can do well. I handle a lot of faith-based movies as a consultant. I like handling faith-based movies, but I, you know, I don't get a lot of them crossing my doorstep. I mean, I don't, you know, it's, you know, they're not made as much as other genres.
Yeah.
And black cinema, you know, black cinema can do very well. Depends on the type of cinema, type of movie, whether it's a drama or a crime drama or, sorry, but a hood movie or whatever, you know, gangster movie. But black cinema could do really well. So, you know, those are the kind of the more or less four categories I would say do well. The films that don't do as well, unless there are names in them, and again, it's iffy. As I said, drama, comedies with no names, very difficult.
Yeah.
Coming of age with no names, very difficult. You know, it's just people want to escape their lives because we are in a time in this 21st century that has been a challenge, certainly over the past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah.
And people want to get away. They don't want to watch the news. They just want to escape for a little while.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that and have seen, you know, as you indicated, the industry across COVID and the habits. And, you know, I mean, who would have thought AVOD would be so big? I mean, I'm still getting checks from a couple of my films from, and they're all from AVOD, of course. So the others have run their course. And
exactly. And if anybody, AVOD, it means ad supported video on demand, just for anybody.
Yes.
And that's Tubi, Amazon Freebie, the Roku channel, Zumo, Pluto, Peacock. Yeah. A whole bunch of them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And those numbers look pretty strong. You know, those numbers out of everything seem to be doing well, and seems like where a lot of us indies can hit our numbers. I have this saying where I say a film fights you every step of the way. What are some hurdles that you've seen or you yourself have had to overcome, or you've seen other filmmakers have had to overcome? Anything that you might be able to offer there?
And at what stage of the journey would you?
It could be anything. It could be from a false perception when they're, you know, pulling something together that they're going to get X talent attached and they have no affiliation. So there's this farce sense of, you know, not untruth, or it could be while they're in production and they've picked this drama with no name and they think that, you know, it's going to be the next Oscar winner. And yet they're just not grounded potentially in that, or other financial challenges, you know, where you're trying to get it through the can and the financing drops out. Are there creative ways that you've seen other people overcome that? You know, I know a lot of filmmakers have had that one where the financing took a left turn at some point, you know, any of those. And to include, you know, of course, distribution and marketing. I've seen filmmakers kind of blow it in that arena too.
Yeah, I mean, I could certainly speak to a lot of examples in that part of the filmmaking journey. I think one of the things I see a lot happening a lot is because I will look at anything. You know, people can submit anything to me through my website, which, by the way, is lionheart.la. Just lionheart.la, not .com. I have a submission form at my site where people can submit, you know, fill out a form and submit their movie. And I'll look at, by the way, I'll look at movies, full-length documentaries. I'll even look at TV series if they're all completed, but I don't look at short films. I don't do anything with short films or short documentaries.
Yeah.
One of the things that I see a lot is that because I'll look at everything, I'd say the number one issue with films, indie films, is the pacing is off, or it runs too long.
Definitely.
Which is also a pacing issue.
Definitely.
It's the writer director edited his or her own film, and they don't understand that they need to step away and let someone else.
That's good.
Tear it down and make it the best it can be. I just watched Well, the film I just mentioned, I looked at last night. That's 2 hours and 2 minutes long. You know, the filmmaker did everything. He acted, starred, you know, starred, wrote, directed, produced, and edited. And he needs to hire a different editor. And actually, he asked me today in an email, what can he do different? And I said, listen, hire an editor who's never seen the film, has not worked on this, and let them go to town. Don't sit in the living room with them or their studio. Let them create a new
Let them
cut,
go.
and then you and the team can come in and watch it and either go, yes, no,
Right.
okay, let's rework some things. Because filmmakers, too many filmmakers fall in love with every word they write and every shot that
Course.
they take.
Yeah.
And they're not able to somehow disassociate from what they've created to be an objective viewer going, I'm bored now. Or, yeah, why do we need? This is a good example of part of this problem. As you, I'm sure, know, Ron, you know, whether it's in script or in shooting, but ideally you start in script. You start a scene after the scene has already started. You end the scene before the scene is over. That's how you keep movies, scenes moving along. And any professional movie pretty much adheres to that. Even Tarantino's movies, even though they'll go off on tangents and whatnot. You know, and so people will start a scene. Someone comes in the room. Hi, how are you? How are you? How's your day going? Fine. I don't need to hear that. The audience
Get
is
in.
already bored. You know, get to the cut to the chase, cut to the bulk, the point of the scene. What's the point of the scene? What do you want to communicate in that scene? Get to it, and then leave. End the scene before the scene is really over. You know, and this is a great example. I know you. Nobody, almost nobody says, okay, good scene on the phone. Good seeing you. All right, take care, Joe. Yeah, you take care, Debbie. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We don't. The phone gets hung up before any of that happens. And
The
the audience never says,
thing up, yeah.
why aren't they saying goodbye? Nobody ever thinks
I
that.
know.
Well, most people don't think that. So it's really, that's the biggest problem with indie film by you know, hands down.
No doubt,
And
yeah.
so I see a film where the pacing is good. I'm like, holy, I just saw a film. Okay, this is interesting. I just saw a film about 2 weeks ago. Really good. Really well done. I hope they choose me. And when I saw the film, I said, man, this is so professional. Everything is just spot on. And I go look up the two filmmakers on IMDb, and they have no movie credits.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, oh my God. I said to them, I said, you guys made a movie. I wouldn't have guessed this is your first movie. This is like somebody's fifth
Awesome.
movie. How do you know? But they have a lot of technical credits, and they've been in the industry a period of time. But they did a killer job on their movie. The pacing's great. The acting's great. That's the other thing. Acting. Half of the indie movies I see, one of the actors is not up to snuff. Little weak, sometimes big time weak, but sometimes a little weak. And I know that's a challenge. If an actor has not been an actor, they may not really, you know, be able to see that every actor they're casting is really right on, really good. And so I would say, any director out there listening to this, if you've never taken an acting class, start taking an acting class, do it for a year, maybe two, so that you're around actors and you get to see the process and you experience the process yourself. I can't stress that enough, because, and I'm being overstating, maybe it's not half, but 35% of the movies I see in the world, one of the actors or a couple of the actors are just not really strong.
I mean, I think it was going around just recently where Ethan Hawke was talking about this very thing, where he was saying that the directors are extremely technical, but they are not have no connection with the actor. And he was like, some of the best directors are former actors, you know, and he went and he had a whole hypothesis of why that is. And I definitely agree with you about getting someone else to cut. I remember one scene in the film. You know, here I am. I'm the producer, writer, director, and I remember how much it cost for the day. We shot this film. It took us the whole day to do, and all this stuff. I remember everything it took to get there, and the editor wanted to cut the scene. And I was like so connected to it because I'm thinking of all the financial, and it wasn't the story. It wasn't like, dang, the pacing. He's probably right. And I said, finally relented, was like, all right, go ahead and remove it. Let's see if it works. And dang, if it wasn't better, you know? And so we had to cut it and we lost that whole scene. You put it in the, you know, you put it on the DVD. It's an extra scene. Throw it in there.
Exactly. And you're right. Cause sometimes there are scenes in films that I'll notice and I'll go, oh, they got that there for the production value because we could have cut that scene.
Yeah.
You know, look, if it's, and you know this, if a film is not production value. We want production value, but that's Absolutely. Not why we're making a film. We're making a film because we want to tell the story. And we want to tell a story that's engaging and it's going to, you know, get your audience to watch it and have fun or learn something or whatever, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. I also can appreciate the editing. I had a fight sequence in a fantasy series, a sword fight. It was so weak. I couldn't figure it out. I sent it to an editor that hadn't seen any of the stuff. I just sent him that sequence. He sent it back to me next day. I had like toiled over it with my editor for like a week. Next day, it was completely different. Fantastic. I gave him a few notes and that's what's in the project. You know, so to your point, sometimes you just got to remove yourself from it. And if you're sitting there over their shoulder, you're pretty much editing. If you're inviting someone to collaborate with you, they have that artistic vision too. Let them do their thing and tell the story, and it will likely be better.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I certainly had my own experience with this issue with my first movie because I had written it. I didn't direct it, but I wrote and produced it and I was in it. And, you know, and I think the way that I got to see so up close and personal how things can change in the editing room is our editor. I had several scenes. It was kind of a talking heads movie. So I had several scenes of a scene with the women on the beach and the scene with the guys in the bar and the scene with the guys there. And I was not in the editing room. And she decided to intercut these sequences in such a way that they really moved. We didn't get bogged down in dialogue. And I was like, wow, that's great. And it worked. And so really, you know, I wouldn't have been able to see it if she hadn't done it. Right. I couldn't see it. You know?
Yeah. You're like, hey, I didn't write it that way. Wait a minute. Go back to
exactly.
But
exactly.
They presented it to you and suddenly it's like, holy cow. You know, it feels like a different movie. Like, wow, that looks professional. I'm in.
So, there are a lot of pitfalls. You know, the creative process is we do the creative process because we want to self-express or we're drawn to it. We want to self-express. We want to tell stories. But there has to be that disassociation at some point to be able to be sure that what we've created really is going to hit with the audience. Unless you want to make a movie and for your, you know, and show your friends in the basement or put it on one of the DIY aggregator platforms where it will probably not make any money, you know.
Right.
Yeah. If you want it, you know, I mean, and there are some people who make personal films and they don't care if anybody else likes them. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's what they want to do, you know.
Yeah. No, you have options in today's market. That's for sure.
Yeah.
If money is not a problem, but is the problem, which is another one of my sayings, are you seeing anything of a way how indies are trying to solve that problem? I mean, certainly crowdfunding has sprung up ad nauseum. We have Patreon, you have equity crowdfunding, you have traditional crowdfunding. You have a lot of various options, but I would be curious to see, just due to your longevity in the business, have you seen anything where indies are solving the problem of financing?
I think crowdfunding has been, you know, has been something that's really helped a tremendous number of filmmakers get their films off the ground and in the can and then, you know, into distribution.
Yeah.
Certainly, and I don't know enough about it to really speak on it, but I know that the Jobs Act was
the 181
during the Obama terms, and so people can invest in films and I guess write it off
that year, right? Exactly.
A lot of people don't know about it, but. You know, if you've got investors who need a write-off because they're making so much money, hey, you know, here's a write-off.
Yeah, exactly. Raise my hand.
So Yeah, I don't know. I have a lot more to add to that other than, yeah, it's, I would say, although you're not asking this necessarily, I would say try to keep your budgets as low as possible.
No, I think that's a good response. Yeah.
Depending upon the kind of movie you're making.
Yeah.
If you're doing an action film, it's hard to keep a budget low. You need probably fight choreographers and stunt
Yeah.
people
Stunts and yeah.
and set pieces.
Yeah.
Drama, comedy, coming of age, those are very cheap to make.
Yep.
But those are the challenges, horror, you can do a decent horror film for not a lot of money.
Yep.
So, that's always, anyways, yeah, I, you know, or maybe if you've got wealthy relatives,
Yeah, friends, families, and fools, right? I mean, that's who I went to initially,
That's
and then
good. I like that. I hadn't heard
I
that
know I people always tell you you're not supposed to use your own money. Everybody says that, but I swear every indie filmmaker I've ever met has put some of their own money. Everyone, 100% across the board. I don't know how else not to do it. I certainly did to kind of get myself started. So if I'm curious to get your take on it because you've been in LA now and in the industry for some time, and this is something I've always been in a pursuit of. How does one in this industry find longevity and contentment within it? Because I f have found that not always to be the case within this industry.
It's a really good question. I will say that I think, anybody who becomes a filmmaker is hoping they can become the next Ava DuVernay or Spike Lee or Clint Eastwood, like I mentioned, or Quentin
Yeah.
Tarantino or whatever. They hope that they can kind of hit it big, Christopher Nolan,
Yeah.
David Fincher, whatever, hit it big with your first movie, your first very low budget indie movie, and you'll have a career. And that happens. For a small number of people, they
Right.
hit the lottery. I
Stellato.
call it a
Yeah.
lottery. They get into
100%.
Sundance, they win an award, they get a big deal, and their career is launched. And
Yeah.
wouldn't we all love that?
Sure.
Everybody
Yeah.
in their
Yeah.
secretly secret fantasy would love for that to happen,
Yeah.
but it's not going to happen for 99% of the people.
Yeah.
So, longevity. I think it's important to find something that you like to do along with filmmaking to sustain yourself, right? I mean, if that's what you've got to do, if you're not wealthy or you don't have a trust fund, you don't have parents who can support you while you spend 10 years or 15 years or whatever, and most of us don't,
Yep.
what can you do in the creative arena that can provide a source of income
That's
while you pursue your filmmaking or your writing or whatever? And I think that's probably the key because every friend of mine here in LA, everyone who's become a good friend of mine, good colleague friend of mine, they have, well, I call it side hustles. They might be their full-time hustle,
right. But yeah.
but it's either a side hustle or a full-time hustle. And then their side businesses, if it's a full-time hustle, their side business is making their own movies.
Right.
But their side hustles or their full-time hustles make them a very good living.
Right.
Whether it's a guy, a friend of mine who does editing, sound, special effects, he owns two Teslas now. He has a house. He's
Right.
making a lot of money. I have another friend who's an editor for a major department in the city of Los Angeles, for the LAPD. He makes a lot of money. He's going to have a pension plan when he decides to leave.
Exactly. Right.
And these guys have time to do other things if they want
Right.
to do other things,
Right.
and they do. I guess my side hustle became my full-time job was distribution.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not trying to make movies at this point. I mean, I'll be producing more movies eventually, but for now I'm happy doing what I'm doing, and I've produced a number of things. I'm happy with what I produced, and now I enjoy the distribution side of things. So,
No, and you're really good at it, man. I've been following you for a while, and you're really good at it. And more importantly, I feel like you're sincere, honest, authentic, and in
Thank
the distribution industry, extremely important and valuable. You don't always find.
I'm a unicorn here.
It's so true. It's sad, but it's so true.
I got screwed big time by my distributor on my first movie, and
Yep.
got screwed out of well into the six figures.
Oh,
So
gosh.
it hurt.
That's hard. Yeah.
Money that could have, you know, I don't know, you know, gone to whatever, you know, and I think that, you know, I just don't, again, just my Zen, I guess, I don't want to perpetuate that crap.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, not to get spiritual here, but at the end of the day, who are we answering to?
Yeah.
We have one, two to answer to, ourselves and maybe to the higher power. And that's it. So we can be criminals our entire life, but when we leave this planet, there's, you know, I'm not saying I believe in hell, heaven, that kind of stuff, but there is going to be some kind of, you know, reviewing that happens in some way, that's what I believe. And that doesn't mean someone's going to go to hell. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, I just look at it as, and accounting, that's the word I'm looking for. I just feel that, you know what? I do believe in that life continues after we're done here in some way. And I want to have a clean slate. I want to have a good slate. I don't want to go, yeah, I screwed that person. Boy, I really screwed that person.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I don't want to, I don't want to do that.
Nah. So. Yeah, I'm with you completely. Feel very similar. And so I definitely appreciate where you're at. With, I'm curious to get your take too. As a distributor, you're trying to build up your film, and we had talked about film festivals. In your mind, how important are they? How should they be utilized? Film festivals. How should a filmmaker look at those?
Well, you brought up my word, or, you know, a word I've used before, pedigree. I see film festivals as a way to build pedigree for your film. Now, they're not the be all end all, unless you get into the top five film festivals in the world. Sundance, Toronto, Cannes, Berlinale, South by Southwest. I put South by Southwest in the top five. They're probably number three in North America now, currently, after Sundance and Toronto.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, if you're in one of the top festivals, then you really have a shot at winning the lottery.
Yeah.
If you're not in one of the top festivals, then you really need to use it to build what I say is pedigree. And for the audience out there, to me, pedigree means awards, if you can get them. You know, awards and accolades, press coverage, good pull quotes from people who might write an article about the festival, and they saw your movie and they say, yeah, the movie, Ron Newcomb's new movie was wonderful. And maybe that's all they say. But you know what? That's a pull quote.
That's right.
From the article. And, you know, the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah.
You know,
says, yeah.
And so reviews, coverage, interviews, even interviews, you know, maybe they don't review your movie, but they do an interview with you in the weekly paper for those that still exist or whatever. Well, that's you know, when you're written about in the media and you have those pieces of press and you have enough of them, distributors like me and people in the industry think, oh, you must be newsworthy. Your movie must be press worthy because you're getting this coverage. If your movie was crap, you wouldn't be getting this. That's what they think, right or wrong. And so you're already leading them down the path of thinking you must have a good movie. And that's important to when we see them. Because when I get, a movie submitted to me, and one of the questions on my input form is, have you been in any film festivals? If so, which one? Have you won awards? I don't know if I say if you won awards, but you know, if you've been in film festivals, I think there is a question there about winning awards. And I look at that before I watch the movie. I look at all the info on the form. And when they've been in film festivals, I do look at the festivals they've been in. And when I see that they're third tier, second tier, that doesn't turn me off. And if they've won awards, I like that, because if they've won enough awards, I think it must not be a piece of crap.
Right.
And so I'm going into the film thinking this is probably going to be a good film. And I want this to be a good film. I want this film to be a film that I want. You know, I don't know if you've heard this, you know, casting directors, if they're honest, will say, When the actor walks in the room, we want that
yeah.
the actor. We want to be done with that part,
right.
that role. We want to move on to the next role.
Right.
And it's the same with me. I'm looking at, you know, I'm probably looking at anywhere from 20 to 30 movies in a month.
Wow.
I wish they were all great. If they were all great, I could be done for the year.
Right. You know? Lock them up and go. Yeah. You know,
and that's a lot of time to check out these films. So, so I want it to be good. And I'll check out that information. If it's got pedigree, that means, okay, great. And even if it's not great, but it's an okay film, well, I may have something to work with. If I want to handle it, I've got something I can work with in marketing. So pedigree is so important. And you can develop pedigree by not doing film festivals. There are other ways to do it. It's harder. You know, if you are able to get Rotten Tomatoes approved critic reviews, you know, from the Rotten Tomatoes website, and you can get 5 reviews before you're in release, well, that's good. You know, that is 5 fresh reviews, 5 good reviews, and then you get a Rotten Tomatoes rating. That's helpful. If you get that, if I've got that, and I think the movie's at least decent, I have something to work with if I want to handle the movie.
Yeah. No,
it makes my job just a little bit easier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it makes it a little shinier. You can pay more attention to it. It helps validate, helps that pedigree.
And by the way, Rotten Tomatoes reviews, a lot of filmmakers don't understand this, but the reviews and the rating. So you have to have 5 approved critic reviews that will show up at Rotten Tomatoes. And when you have 5, you get a rating. And that rating, as well as there's 2 ratings, the rating and then the audience score. And that gets pulled by Vudu, which is being rebranded as Fandango or Fandango at Home or something soon. Mm. But Fandango owns Vudu. But that gets pulled onto the screen. So when people are looking at movies on Vudu, they're going to see whether a movie's got the fresh tomato or the rotten tomato. And then that's why that's important. The ratings all get, you know, when Amazon pulls their ratings from IMDb, I mean, everybody's pulling ratings. A lot of these platforms are pulling ratings from various places. So that's important. Helps people go, this is not a piece of crap. If they see a smash tomato and it says 22%.
Yep.
Are people going to pay $5 for that? If it's
right,
a horror film,
have a problem. Probably not. Exactly. We talked about festivals. How about the markets? Where do you see the future of the markets? Do you see it potentially going all online, or, you know, obviously in the States we have AFM, but there's, you know, Berlin and, you know, all the markets over in Asia and Toronto. Where do you see the markets at and the kind of future of the markets?
Hard to say. I mean, I don't necessarily want to prognosticate because everybody who prognosticates is wrong eventually.
Right.
You know, remember Steven Spielberg and George Lucas said theaters would die. Well, they aren't dying.
They
haven't died. I mean, a number of indie theaters have closed because of the pandemic, but you know, that business is coming back slowly and it'll come back eventually. I think that, you know, the truth is that a lot of international sales agents that companies that do international distribution, and by the way, I only do domestic for your audience. I only do domestic distribution, US and Canada. I don't deal with international. And I recommend that your audience, for the filmmakers out there, that you bifurcate the rights. Don't give all your rights to one company that does the world, because the international sales companies are good with the international markets.
Right.
What most of them do, 98-99% of them, they just farm out the domestic rights to a company like me, and then they take a slice of that pie as well. And vice versa. If you go with a domestic company that is only really domestic, and they want the world, most of them will just farm out the rights to an international sales company and take a slice of that pie. So if you bifurcate the rights, you're not putting all your eggs in one basket. So that said, a lot of the international sales agents, they don't have to attend a market to make deals. They can send screeners by email, you know, links and posters, and they can do a lot of business by phone and email. That said, I think that the markets will continue to exist for a period of time, maybe forever, but for a period of time, because there's an aspect of face-to-face, which is really important in the film business.
Yeah.
And if you never met someone, you know, it's just a difference. And it could be that the international buyers that buy films from distributors, you know, they want to usually meet people one-on-one at some point in time. I feel the same way. So I think the traditional markets will be around for some time to come.
What I like about particularly the foreign markets is they're usually attached to a film festival. So one of the top tier festivals are going on, and there's also a market going on, which is why, you know, over in Berlin, why are all these stars walking the red carpet? Well, it's because they also have a market. Yeah, you know,
exactly. I mean, Berlin Ali and Cannes are notorious in that. And that's a great point, Ron. And I think that's true. I think those will definitely be around probably forever because they are attached to a well-known market where the international press, you know, all goes to cover stuff.
Yeah.
The AFM, I don't know. I think the AFM will be around, and maybe partly because most of the international sales companies, you know, 90% of them or 85% of them are based here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So they don't have to travel.
Exactly.
And if the buyers are willing to come from overseas, then it will continue. If at some point the buyers decide, well, I don't need to go to LA.
Yeah.
I don't need to spend $20,000 and bring my team, you know, then it might die at some
point. We'll have to adjust. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe go online or God only knows. I do like the face-to-face too. And if you've never gone to AFM, it is a cool experience. Make sure you go in the latter part of the week though. But if you've gone to AFM, if you haven't gone, definitely check it out. One kind of, as we're winding down here, I would invite you to speak as much as you feel comfortable, of course, speaking about this, but I think filmmakers are clueless at times when it comes to the deal. And I will not hold you to anything. Just you can talk in generalities, but do you have any ballpark that you can give a filmmaker, at least for them to have a starting point? Because so many filmmakers really have no starting point. And what I mean by that is, you know, how many years might a film get locked up? Maybe 15. And sure. What's kind of acceptable? And then, you know, what percentage should I expect? Is it 30%, 35%? And, you know, that types of things. And certainly, to let you off the hook, I know it depends. You know, if your film is wanted and won a bunch of awards, you know, that changes things, and you can negotiate if you have leverage a lot more than you can. So it definitely depends on leverage. And that could be talent. That could be if you just won Sundance. It could be that pedigree.
Right.
But just in general, do you have any kind of ballpark that you could speak to about kind of the deal?
All right. And we're talking about me personally, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So my standard distribution, okay, so distribution fees can be all over the map. They can be all over the map domestically. They can be all over the map with international sales companies. They tend to range anywhere from 20 to 50%. 50% in my opinion is too high. Even 40% in my opinion is too high. For a domestic deal, you really ought to be down to between 20 and 30%. I'm at the low end of that. Right now, I'm currently at 20% distribution fee. And if you've got names in your cast, if you've got a really stellar cast, well, you know, maybe you can get a distributor down to 15%, perhaps. I don't know if I should admit this on video, but I actually did go down to 15% on a particular movie recently because it's got someone in it that everybody knows, and and I wanted the film. So, you know, the producer is very savvy, and he negotiated well with me to get it to that point. And I said, okay. I don't typically do that though. It just depends on the film.
I appreciate it.
But anybody listening to this video, if you don't have Brad Pitt in your film and you want 15,
right, exactly. You got to justify it. Yeah.
But you know, you got a very important star in your film, you know, so that is leverage that you can use with distributors. The other thing in terms of term, length of time, Most distributors are domestic distributors are anywhere from 3 to 10 to 15 years. 3 is the low end. 10 to 15, 10 to 12 to 15 is the high end. I think that's too long. My own term is 2 years. So I'm lower than most everybody else.
Yeah, no, you are.
For the very reason that if it doesn't go well, like if you aren't happy with me in this journey, I don't feel you should be tied to me with a ball and chain for another 8 years or 10 years.
That's great.
You'll badmouth me to everybody you talk to if you don't like me. So I believe in cutting people loose if it doesn't go well. And that's basically, and by the way, the 2 years is really ends up being a year and a half, because by the time a contract is signed, usually it takes months for the filmmaker to get the deliverables done and to me.
Yeah.
And then there's a time to pitching, getting on.
Yeah. You got a sales channel. Out. Yeah.
So, you know, that's 6 months typically right there. I wish it wasn't, but every filmmaker takes longer than they think it's going to take to get the deliverables together. So that's length of term. One other thing that you didn't mention, but I will, is expenses. This is where most producers get hurt. They sign these contracts that allow for the distributor to recoup 10 or 15 or 25 or $50,000 in expenses.
Yeah.
Guess what? If you have an indie film without stars, they are not going to spend that kind of money marketing your movie. So it's just a profit center for them to, you know, divert money that should go to you into their pockets. Now, not every distributor does this, okay?
Right.
But many do. There's a lot of corruption out there. But also, by the way, and this is important because I'm not trying to slam my colleagues out there, but you know, if you sign a contract that allows them to recoup, say, $30,000 in expenses, well, if you sign that contract, that's legal, that's legit.
Yeah, you signed it.
Don't think it's ethical. So, so don't do it, in my opinion.
Right.
Keep the expenses as low as possible.
Yeah.
I just negotiated on behalf of a film I'm handling domestically with an international sales company that got wind of it or whatever, and they wanted to handle it. They saw the film, and so I helped the filmmaker, and I negotiated the contract for them. And they had a certain level of expenses for year one, year two, year three. And I said, listen, let's negotiate this. You know, can we negotiate this? I want to negotiate this. We got it down. We got the first year down to very low, second year down to very even lower, and then zero on year three. So, you know, if somebody really wants your film, right, the leverage, you can negotiate. If they won't negotiate, there's a very prominent distributor out there that everybody knows about, and they have a $25,000 marketing expense cap in their contract. Now, it's a cap. Can't go over 25K, but they have another $7,500 in the contract for legal. And that's automatic. That's going to come off the top. So $7,500 off the top. Then they allow for up to 25K in marketing. Whether they use that or not, who knows? So you have potentially a $32,500 hill to climb before you see a penny. And I don't recommend people do those kinds of deals. If you've got, you know, Kate Winslet in your movie, okay. If somebody wants to spend 20K on marketing, they might really do so. But then you really should negotiate exactly what that marketing will entail and consecrate that in the contract.
Yeah.
So that it has to be spent.
Yeah.
Or if they say, well, listen, we, you know, Distributor X, we're going to spend 20K marketing this, guaranteed. Well, would you consider giving me that 20K and let me do the marketing?
Yeah. Yep.
I have proposed that to filmmakers when I was consulting. Sometimes that would come up. I'd say, why don't you go to them and say, listen, instead of that advance, instead of that promise to market, how about if you make that the advance, I'll do the marketing. or I'll hire the people to do the marketing and I'll control the money. I'll control that aspect of it. I mean, you know, so everything's negotiable in my opinion. Now I will say this, there's a handful of distributors, and I think you know this, Ron, there's a handful of distributors out there that really are reputable and aren't going to rip you off. So it's not an entirely, you know, crocodile filled pond. And some of the contracts are very favorable and very fair to the filmmaker. So I would say when you come across one of those contracts, don't, you know, nickel and dime the word here and a word there, whatever. If it's a fair contract and it's airtight, it might be a really good contract. And you can always do due diligence and talk to people who've worked with that distributor to see if they're good, if they're reputable, if you get your statements on time, if you get any monies owed on time, things like that. You know, I actually had, not to toot my own horn, but I actually gave a contract. My contract's very fair to filmmakers. I gave my contract to somebody's film that I wanted, and he sent it to his entertainment attorney. And entertainment attorney came back last week and said he has never seen a contract this fair to filmmakers before.
Signed the deal.
thank you for sharing that with me. I mean, I really, and there's a couple other companies that I know you know who they are that are, you know, that also have very fair contracts. But, and the last piece I'll say about the contract is, no matter what, have an attorney review it.
Yes.
And have an entertainment attorney review it.
Yes.
Not a music attorney, not a divorce attorney, not a real estate attorney, an entertainment attorney. And here's why. Last year, a movie came to me. I wanted to handle it. It was in black and white, which is really not good. So anybody making black and white movies, I recommend you don't do it. The audience doesn't want to watch black and white movies, generally speaking, unless you're a baby boomer and you watch Turner Movie Classics or something.
Right.
And I'm not pissing on black and white movies. It's just that the audience don't want to watch
another,
black and white movies.
Show.
So anyway, it was a black and white movie, but it was well done. It was a drama. And I felt there was an audience for it. So I gave them my contract. It's 6 pages long. It's not one of those 20 or 30 page contracts. They didn't have an entertainment attorney. They went to a music attorney who redlined 2 of the 6 pages.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah. I mean, there might be a couple things you want to negotiate with me. Like, you know, I don't know, you know, but a third of the contract was strike through a red line. No, you know, so go to an entertainment attorney who understands the lingo, the language, the terms.
Definitely.
What is standard practice? And, you know, and you should read it yourself as well. But you read it, you come up with questions, you give it to your attorney, and then you guys talk about it. That's my best advice.
No, I think that's a great idea. And actually, I have read those contracts that I personally read. And at first I thought I was just going to have to grudge through it, but it actually wasn't that bad. There's a lot of common language that you can go, oh, okay, I'm understanding this. But I would also say, cause I had a friend who was an attorney, said, be willing to take a look at it. And he just ended up with a million questions, you know, because he just wasn't in the industry and had no idea even what the standard was or what the deal is. So he can certainly look at it from a contractual legal obligation point of view. But unless he's an entertainment attorney and sees these things, he has no idea what the standard might be. So kind of like what you just said about you receiving something redlined, that's kind of what he was doing, is that he was challenging things that, come to find out, were very normal and standard in the industry. And it would have been very in poor taste for me to come back and try to, you know, twist that to the distributor, when the distributor is like, wow, man, these things are negotiable, but that's like in every contract, you know?
Yeah. I mean, exactly. There's the rights granted in many contracts. It's a paragraph long. Sometimes it's a long paragraph, but it covers all the rights, and the terms used are standard terms. So if the case were to go to court, let's say in Los Angeles or New York, where the judge is going to be, especially LA, where the judges are going to be familiar with what is standard and not, and how things are adjudicated, they're going to look at the paragraph and go, okay, well, you know, they have these rights, you know, and an attorney who's not in the entertainment industry is going to be, I don't know what this stuff is.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. And you could find yourself, I know we're all trying to save money, but that's not the time to scrimp. get an attorney and review it.
Exactly. And here's the other thing, and you've discovered this for yourself, is that the more you read contracts, by the fifth, sixth, seventh contract, you're going to you don't have a problem reading them. You understand everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really important. You know, governing, the first time you see governing law, you're like, what the heck is governing law? Yeah. Well, it's simple. Yeah. And it's adjudicated definite meaning what governing law is in what state, et cetera. Yep. Everybody knows, everybody in the legal area knows, every judge knows that doesn't have to be messed with if it's clear, or arbitration, what is arbitration? Well, everybody knows what arbitration is. That's in the illegal world. And then there's pros and cons. There's pros and cons about whether you should have arbitration in your contract or not. But I don't know if we want to get into that because, some entertainment attorneys like, yes, have the arbitration paragraph in there. Others are like, no, don't.
Right.
Because if you have that in there, it's usually an advantage to the distributor. So, I don't know.
Yeah. I definitely hear you. And I totally agree. Those sound extremely fair. Actually, your deal sounds very favorable to the filmmaker. That would be ecstatic to get 2 years, 20%. I mean, that's just fantastic. I was getting things 15 years, 35%, those were the deals that I was receiving. And thank you for calling out expenses. All my contract had major expenses within them. And that is where, money goes to die. That's where they can pull their profit from. And you can't, if you don't put a cap on it, there's no cap. So they can just justify and say, hey, that was a marketing expense.
There has to be a cap. There has to be a number. And there has to be language that says, this is the cap or this is the maximum. It can't go over unless there is written approval by the filmmaker. And that's important. Filmmaker. Written approval to go over the cap. Written approval by the person signing the contract. Because sometimes, if you negotiate it down to, let's say, $5,000 or something really low, but the distributor says, look, something could happen. This could blow up in the marketplace. Yeah. Right. Spend more money. Great. Then you know what? Then with approval from me, written approval from me, I will let you do so.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
And so caps are important. And, there are so many opportunities for distributors to put in little and again, I used this before, little profit centers built into their contracts. And here's a new one that's happened within the past year, 2 years. When a distributor spends money on your movie, a lot of distributors are now adding language that they get to earn interest on that money that they've spent until it's recouped. Now, it seems maybe a little innocuous, like how much money could that be? Well, I don't know, prime plus whatever. Maybe 10%. What if they spend money or on the advance, right? If you get an advance. So let's say you get an advance of 10K and then they're going to spend 10K on expenses. That's 20K. And let's say they don't recoup for a year. Well, that might be another $2,000 they make off of your movie if it's 10%. And if it's 2 years, that's double. So I don't agree with that. But I understand that that's what a lot of distributors, there's always these little, and they're either obvious or they're hidden. And that's where you have to learn how to read contracts and then have a good attorney review. So,
yeah, exactly. And they can
sorry to bore your audience with the in the weeds stuff.
No, exactly. This is the business stuff that, again, I think you and I both saw people responding to that people realize oh my gosh, I need to know these things because no one's teaching it. And you're one of the few people out there that has really been an advocate for filmmakers and trying to do fair deals and just get stories told and get stuff out there in the proper way. And now you've got, I won't throw a number out, but a significant number of years on behind your belt doing this stuff. You already mentioned Lionheart Distribution is your company, right? Lionheart.la. And people can just go on there. And what you're looking for predominantly is finished product, mostly features, documentaries, and you'll even look at television. And you can go right on Jerome's website, lionheart.la. It'll be in the show notes and you can submit through there. I would encourage you to do so. I can't speak more highly of Jerome. Extremely knowledgeable, very nice guy. Always answered my emails anytime I've ever had a question. So please do reach out to Jerome. Do you have anything that you're currently working on? Anything that you wanted to kind of set up for people to hear about? Any way we could support you?
Send me good movies.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
keep your ear out.
If you're a filmmaker and you don't have anything, but you've got a colleague or a friend who's just finished a movie, yeah, send them my way. Say, hey, listen, here's the podcast that the interview that Ron Newcomb did with Jerome. Go listen to it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's, that's how I can be supported. I mean, look, I we do what we do. We do what we do here because we love it. And I really love finding good films, good stories being told, and getting them into the marketplace. And, and I have some films coming out this spring. I mean, I usually have I'm very selective. I know I probably might've implied this before. I'm very selective. I probably only pick up about 1 out of 9 or 10 movies that I look at. Because I do spend actual time and energy on the film, and I help market the film. I like it when filmmakers market with me. But usually most of the time I'm going to spend a certain amount of time and energy and some money on marketing. And I want the films to be successful. That's important, because if they're not successful, then nobody's making any money. And yeah. I only make money if the film is making money. So from my distribution fee. So that's why I'm selective. And so I'm looking forward to a handful of films that are slated for release in April and May. And
Awesome. Yeah, no, we'll definitely keep our eye out on the internet. I appreciate everybody watching. I appreciate Jerome, your time and your expertise, your knowledge, your experience for good or bad. I hope people take that and learn from it and improve upon it and allow this to be your floor. You know, our ceiling is your floor. Move them on. You know, let's keep telling stories and getting them out there. And if you do have something, get it over to Jerome. I appreciate you all listening. I believe we are good to conclude at this time. The discussion was great, and I'll see you on the next one. Thanks, team.
Thank you, everybody.